Iambic Audiobooks and Invisible Publishing present Migration Songs by Anna Kwan. Read by Elizabeth Klett. Chapter 1. I want to remember the day I was born, that rainy day in September. My parents have told me the story so many times that I can feel my mother's hands on me, slippery with afterbirth. There is a stench of lightning, a hot smell from inside my mother's body. But in her hands I am cooling, becoming solid, becoming real, like a photo in fixing solution, shedding all other possibilities. My mother was out in the yard in her rubber boots and rain poncho, picking late summer tomatoes for supper. She bent over to grasp one, and when she straightened up, something dropped, like an elevator inside her plummeting toward the ground floor. It was her water breaking. "And you," my mother likes to say, "the one who pushed the elevator button, were not far behind." There was no time to get to the hospital. My mother leaned against the kitchen table, holding her belly in one hand and the phone in the other. She called my father, who worked as a hospital administrator, and told him to come home. As usual on a Saturday, he was catching up on his paperwork, but he arrived soon after, ahead of the ambulance, which just goes to show how fast he must have driven our battered old Chrysler. Breathless, his dark hair plastered to his head from the rain, he found my mother sitting on the kitchen floor in a sticky pool which clung to the soles of his boots as he came to her. She cradled me, her first-born child, between her legs, the umbilical cord still intact, and looked at him with what my father describes as a mixture of astonishment and accusation, as if she could not believe what had just happened, and was blaming my father for it. My mother remembers it slightly differently. "I held your little head in my hands, and when I looked up, there was your father standing soaking wet in the doorway with his mouth open. He'd forgotten his briefcase. You looked so alike, him with his red face and hair stuck to his head, and you with yours, that I was astonished. Your father is right about that. It was as if I held in my arms your father's younger self, although in the form of a girl." "Help me cut the cord, then," she told my father, who continued to stand there, gaping. "Like a stranger," she told me later in private, "who'd just happened on the scene." But then the ambulance arrived, with Dr. Jameson, our next-door neighbor, close behind, poking his head around the doorframe. My father was pushed helplessly aside to hover in the background, while the doctor and the ambulance attendants took care of my mother and me. My mother often says that instead of her going to the hospital to have me, the hospital came to her, including the ambulance, doctor, and even the administrator. It is her one brilliant joke. My father smiles each time, or maybe grimaces is a better word. My mother claims I was in such a hurry to arrive that I left my briefcase behind, which she can sometimes feel floating around inside her, like a lost piece of luggage. She says the briefcase contained my instruction manual, and without it she wasn't sure how to raise me. But she says she figures she did all right. I am not so sure. At 29, I am a nervous wreck, a train wreck of a human being. For one thing, I'm addicted to cough drops, and I haven't been able to keep a job for more than 6 months. Because of that, I've moved back home with my parents. My father is retired, and after working for 3 decades at progressively more senior administrative positions at the hospital, he can't understand why I drift from job to job, and why I am now struggling to keep my current one as an elementary school bus driver. A bus driver, for Christ's sake. That's what I hear him thinking, behind his study door in the evening. My father is an Englishman, with the black hair and blue eyes of an Irishman, which earned him some teasing as a boy. He's been in Canada since before I was born, but he still refuses to sing O Canada or pledge allegiance to the Queen. He's anti-monarchy and fancies himself a socialist. He grew up in York, in a working-class family, and was the first of his clan to go to university. There he studied classics and literature, much to his own father's concern. But because my father could spell, and because he was a good typist, he was never short of work after he graduated and moved to London. At his first job he made more money than his own father ever had. My father met my mother in 1970 in Hyde Park. There was a crowd of students gathered around a young Chinese man with a bullhorn who was shouting, "Long live Chairman Mao!" He also shouted some other things, but his accent was so thick it was hard to understand him, my father says. My mother was standing in the crowd a few feet away, with a bemused smile on her face. She was, says my father, as lovely as a lotus blossom, her black hair hanging limp and impenetrably dark, her cheeks flushed from the damp air. Her features were Chinese, he says, but instead of socialist drab, she wore an orange mini-dress. When she thrust her arm out to salute Chairman Mao, my dad swears she was in fact mouthing the words, "Long live the Queen." She glanced over at him, and he was transfixed. My father doesn't sit with my mother and me watching the news on TV after dinner anymore, but goes directly to his study. Just the fact that he even has a study in this day and age is a clue to what kind of man he is. Private, retiring, well-read. On special occasions he smokes a cigar in there, and the smooth scent of it creeps out from under the study door. The aroma of my father's absence. There was a time when his study was a special place where I could come to sit, in a leather chair with brass studs all around the seat, and read a book from his shelves. They were mostly far over my head, swimming with small print and big words that I didn't know. My father would nod approvingly as if just by opening one of those books the magic of knowledge would rub off on me. On his 40th birthday my father invited me into his study. He put the painted rock paperweight that I had made him as a gift on the corner of his desk and leaned back in his chair, appraising me. He seemed satisfied. His dark eyes were warm with tenderness, something that I did not often see. For the most part he was a handsome man to my mind, but there was always disappointment lurking in him, which made him appear sad and awkward. He handed me his cigar. "Don't tell your mother," he whispered, and seemed happy, almost buoyant. I held it in my hands, then put it to my mouth, and inhaled. My father later told me that I turned green before throwing up on his Persian rug. All I remember is feeling queasy, and then I was lying on the floor, staring up at the ceiling. My father was standing over me with a perplexed and concerned look. It is the same look he gives me now that I am almost 30 and teetering on the edge of unemployment. In high school I started to drift off course, though at first even my mother didn't realize anything was wrong. My friends were abnormally bright and sarcastic, bored with the world and at the same time diligently keeping their marks up. I didn't realize that what I thought of as their ennui and alienation, which I admired, were a teenage occupation, not meant to last. Conventional and timid, I took up the cause of boredom and apathy with gloomy enthusiasm, and gradually lost myself in them. My parents expected me to go to university, to make something of myself, an accountant or even a doctor or a lawyer. I remember my father at my graduation, standing with his arm around my shoulders, admiring my diploma. The school principal, a jovial, big-bellied, middle-aged man, came up to us and asked in a booming voice that made other parents and students turn and look, "So, Joan, what letters are you going to be putting after your name?" I felt the blood creeping into my cheeks. "M.D.? Ph.D.?" he bellowed. He slapped me on the back, and my father looked at me and beamed. Sometimes I catch my father looking at me over the top of his paper at breakfast, his dark eyes pained, incredulous, as if to say, "What are you doing here? What are you doing?" My mother still works at the supermarket. She's a bookkeeper, but sometimes she fills in on cash when one of the girls is sick. She was the one who suggested I take a year off after high school, to find myself. She was probably uneasy with how much time I was spending in my room, staring out the window when I was supposed to be studying. She probably sensed the unhappiness at my core, which bloomed like a dark, night-loving flower. Well, I had lost myself all right, but finding myself was not going to be as easy as finding a pair of keys. Retracing my steps only leads me back through a series of dim, low-ceilinged rooms, until I emerge into full sunlight at about age 8. Backward from there, each year is like a brilliant capsule, well-defined, glowing with promise. But although I have tried, I cannot bring those luminous days forward. Once I step back into the house of my future, I am overcome with the dank, musty smell of things left lying in the dark, of decay and erosion. My therapist, Dr. Bard, is an unreasonably bubble-headed optimist. When I show up for my appointment, he bounces to the door to greet me, ushering me in with a smile that says, "I'm so glad to see you." Tall and lanky, with a dark beard and mustache, there is something wounded and sensitive about his doggedness. He lets me arrange myself in the easy chair across from him. Then he leans forward in his chair, with his hands folded together on his desk, and his index fingers pointing somewhere in the region of my forehead. Still smiling brightly, he waits for me to say something. I clear my throat. "Well," I say. He leans forward eagerly. "Yes?" he asks. I look up at the ceiling. Like a puppy with a ball that is too big for it, he tries again. "Well, how was your week?" he asks.
"It was fine,"
he pounces. "Well, tell me about it." The last thing I want to do is to tell him about it. My mother pays for me to come here and sit in his office, which I do, but that is all. Dr. Bard thinks there is something preventing me from healing my past, which is interfering with my ability to get on with my life. Actually, he has never said this. I have imagined him thinking it, though, as he tries to guide me through self-hypnosis back into my childhood, which he wants me to reclaim. All the while I sit there with my eyes closed, feeling self-conscious and miserable, pretending to follow his instructions. Occasionally, though, I forget myself and end up in those early years where I am no longer a stranger to my own life. For so long it was my parents' story that gripped me, overshadowing my own. My life has always been merely a tendril off the vine of theirs, creeping toward the sunshine. It never bothered me to be a sideshow, an afterthought. But something calls to me from the future, a bird sound, like that of geese in flight, faint but insistent, a song of remembering, pushing out feathers I never knew were mine. End of chapter 1.